All right, so John chapter 2. Chapter 1's a hard act to follow, but chapter 2 is pretty cool. Most of it, of course, is the wedding feast at Cana. Cana is immediately outside of Nazareth. In fact, when you stand in Cana, you see all of Nazareth kind of in front of you. It's probably, I don't know, not 5 miles. Probably less than that. I don't know. A couple miles. It's a completely Muslim city, and it's a little scary there. I never like parking the car there, because there's always like people looking at you and walking around. So is Nazareth for that matter. But anyway, so chapter 2, the wedding feast of Cana, of course, is known for a lot of things. Jesus' first miracle. Jesus, blessing the sacrament of matrimony, blessing the marriage. Showed that, he and his apostles had fun going to a wedding. And but then, of course, there was some tension involved. So I think what we'll do is somebody who wants to read, since everybody knows about the wedding feast, so maybe somebody just read verses 1 through 11.
On the third day, there was a wedding in Cana in Galilee, and the mother of Jesus was there. Jesus and his disciples were also invited to the wedding. When the wine ran short, the mother of Jesus said to him, "They have no wine." And Jesus said to her, "Woman, how does your concern affect me? My hour has not yet come." His mother said to the servants, "Do whatever he tells you." Now, there were 6 stone water jars there for Jewish ceremonial washings, each holding 20 to 30 gallons. Jesus told them, "Fill the jars with water." So they filled them to the brim. Then he told them, "Draw some out now and take it to the head waiter." So they took it, and when the head waiter tasted the water that had become wine without knowing where it had come from, although the servers who had drawn the water knew, the head waiter called the bridegroom and said to him, "Everyone serves good wine first, and then when the people have drunk freely, an inferior one, but you have kept the good wine until now." Jesus did this as the beginning of his signs in Cana in Galilee, and so revealed his glory, and his disciples began to believe in him.
Okay, let's pause there. So, John's the book of signs and wonders. And you see how this starts out? On the third day. Remember, John starts it like it's a parallel to the creation story. It's a parallel to Genesis. It's the new creation. So on the third day, first day and second day, he's picking disciples, and there's all the cool stuff with Andrew and Nathaniel. And so on the third day, there's this wedding feast. He has these days. So it's the first miracle, signs and wonders, and of course, it shows power. And the interesting thing is the first miracle is done in an out-of-the-way place. I mean, Nazareth was a jerk town then. Cana's even smaller than Nazareth. I mean, there were probably a few hundred people living there. He didn't do the miracle in Jerusalem, or he didn't do the miracle in Capernaum, or he didn't do the miracle in some bigger place. He did it in kind of an out-of-the-way place. And he did it at a wedding feast. He did it at a celebration of a man and a woman getting married. So he gives importance to that. And of course, through the whole Bible, there's also what's called the bridal paradigm, like you find in the Song of Songs, for example. I think we did that here years ago. But you find it in Isaiah, that, God says, I who am your creator have become your husband. He says, I am a husband to Israel. Israel commits adultery. Jeremiah says, Israel commits adultery on every green hill and under every tree. And she sits by the side of the road waiting for another lover to come by. So, you know, the no other nation's called them a harlot or a prostitute except Israel. Because God says, I'm married to her, and she's always going after other lovers. And we could, of course, make the parallel, too, because the church is the bride of Christ. Mm-hmm. So, you know, if the church is the bride of Christ, if we're, you know, married to him, you know, why do we go after other stuff? Why do we go after other lovers? So there's this bridal paradigm when we did the Song of Songs here years ago. And so, you know, there's this what's called bridal paradigm. So he's there with a man and a woman getting married. And you can take it back to even the relationship within the Godhead. You know, the marriage is a reflection of the Trinity. And you hear that in wedding ceremonies. And I don't remember exactly how the wording goes, but there's a close, intimate love of the parties that are involved. Now, we're not comparing, you know, husband and wife on earth with the Trinity, but it's a mirror of that. And, of course, it's a covenant. It's not a contract. Civil marriage is a contract. I mean, you could never go to the church and say, well, you know, we want you to do our wedding, Father Joe, and here's the contract we've decided on. And, you know, as you see here in section two, after we've had three arguments, if we have three arguments, then it makes the rest of the contract null and void. You wouldn't get very far with that. You certainly wouldn't make it through the honeymoon. But anyway, but that's the difference between a covenant and a contract. A covenant is an intimate exchange. And so this comes out in this too, because he's there. The first miracle's done in that kind of a setting. I always wondered why he was invited with his apostles, and Mary was there apparently separately. I don't know, maybe they picked her up on the way over. I don't know. You know, and I don't know whether if Jesus got invited separately, did he say to the host, is it okay if I bring, you know, some other guys with me? But anyway, because, you know, these ancient weddings used to go on for days. Used to go on a long time. It was a huge celebration. And you figure when you have this kind of a sort of mundane life of working the thing, the kind of drudgery of everything, you know, when you have a wedding, that's like kind of a release of, oh boy, let's have some fun now for a change. You notice too that Joseph isn't mentioned. Saint Joseph is not mentioned. So, you know, Jesus is 30 at this point. So the last time we hear about Saint Joseph, Jesus is 12. So sometime between 12 and 30, he dies. Which is another interesting thing. Wouldn't you love to have had some, we're not given any information about that. You know, Jesus could have healed them. Even if Jesus was 14, you know, he could have healed them. Could have raised them from the dead. This is how it was supposed to be. And, you know, so he's clearly not there. Mary clearly is there. And John calls her the mother of Jesus. It's kind of interesting. There were many, 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 many women named Miriam. It was, you know, it sounds, you know, when I read those Easter accounts, I can't figure it out. It sounds like she has a sister named Mary. And I said, could her parents not think of any other names? They couldn't name her, like, you know, Sally or something? Yeah. You know? But, yeah, they had plenty of good Jewish names to choose from. But, you know, so there were plenty of women named Miriam. So, you know, he points out this is Miriam, the mother of Jesus. I mean, if he just wrote Mary, you know. So Joseph's not mentioned. So this is interesting, too, because Jesus comes to a celebration where there's eating and there's drinking and there's dancing. And, you know, in The Chosen, he's dancing and doing, but, you know, I'm sure he didn't come to the wedding and just sit in the corner and, you know, fold his hands and watch everybody. You know, and this is my opinion, you know, you may think differently. I mean, my opinion is he would have gotten involved in the celebration. And creepy John the Baptist, you know, didn't do stuff like that. You know, some of those aesthetic people, those Nazarites, you know, they didn't eat and drink and celebrate. You know, they even ask Jesus, the Pharisees even ask him, how come your disciples don't fast? All the other ones do. He says, hey, well, they're not fasting now while I'm here. They'll have plenty of time to fast later when I'm not here. Because he's celebration. You know, he comes in a different way than all those guys did. You know, early in Matthew's gospel, it talks about how John the Baptist didn't come eating and drinking. Jesus comes to this place because he's going to celebrate. He could have passed and said to the apostles, you know what, I'm invited to a wedding, but, you know, I don't want to go into that eating and drinking and celebrating thing. So let's just go over there. And no, so he goes into this whole atmosphere. And, you know, when you come to be his follower, then you're invited to a feast as well. You have to fast from time to time, but he's a sign of total blessing. Just like when the people in the wilderness are heading toward the promised land, it's the land of milk and honey, which, of course, we just got done with a Torah class. You know, it's a sign of prosperity and plenty of stuff to eat and fertile land is a sign. Then we're wandering and going to the ultimate promised land, which is heaven, which is, you know, heaven's called the marriage supper, the marriage feast. Mm-hmm. So there's a feasting that's involved. And so right away, well, not right away, we don't know how long they were there. They were probably looking at the food in the buffet going, I don't like that. That one's good. Yeah, when do we eat?
Caterer.
Yeah. It doesn't say the same thing here about Thomas being the caterer, like in The Chosen. But
yeah.
Yeah. But anyway, Mary gets obviously very concerned about this problem. Now, she's probably very good friends with the people that are getting married. I mean, probably with their parents. Because she's probably, you know, at least mid-40s by this time. Mid to late 40s. So she knows these people probably. It doesn't say that they're relatives, and it doesn't really say she knows them, but you get the impression she's very concerned about, she doesn't want them to be embarrassed. She doesn't want them to come out and say, I hate to tell you this, everybody, but there's no more wine, and everybody start going, what do you mean there's no more wine?
They have to end it because they have to end water.
That's right. They drink the end of the celebration. She might have said, how's everything going? And somebody goes, oh, not good. We got, you know, 3 more glasses of wine left. and the way these guys are drinking. So Jesus gives this kind of strange response where it's like, he sounds like he doesn't want to be bothered. Now, there's different interpretations for this word woman, because it sounds kind of harsh and kind of tense and like dismissive. Yeah. Woman, why are you telling me this? We wouldn't even say that to a woman who asked you something in a store. You wouldn't say, woman, why are you asking me this? Because everybody would think you were a creep. In this Hebrew culture, a man would have addressed his mother with a respectful term that can be translated as woman, but meant like a very special woman. But I don't know. But then when he says, you know, my time hasn't come. Mm-hmm. Now, another thing to look at with that is he knows there's going to be a time where
she does too, obviously.
Yeah, where the events are going to start moving toward the cross. Mm-hmm. You know, in his humanity, does he think, oh, you know, if I get involved with this now, if I'm going to do a miracle, I mean, he knew he was going to do it, but if I'm going to do a miracle here, does this start off the public ministry life? And is this, you know, moving toward the cross? But it sounds like, you know, why should I be worried about this? My time's not come yet. So Mary kind of submits to the situation, says, do whatever he tells you. Maybe he's just going to say, oh, I got to help these people out. Or maybe he's just going to say, yeah, you know, I really should, or, you know, but do what he tells you. She doesn't say, oh, forget it, he's not going to do anything. So my hour's not yet come. So do whatever he tells you. So she points to him. So now the attention is off of her. She points to him to do what he tells you. She doesn't say, oh, wait, I'll go ask him again, or I'll go, you know, check with maybe one of his disciples will talk him into it, or maybe some, and she goes, do whatever he says. So she kind of turns it over to him. So, you know, that's interesting. So he's going to be the way this problem is going to be fixed. I've done what I'm supposed to do. So then here we go. So here we go with these ceremonial washings, because so much, we're not going to spend a lot of time on this, because so much washing had to do with, some of it is from the law, most of it was from tradition. But this is all, these are huge stone jars. I mean, they hold a lot of water. Yeah. And keep in mind, this is important to the story. This is important to how it unravels, because first of all, they live in a desert. Secondly, you know, you can add up, you know, most people say there were at least 72 gallons of water involved. I mean, 72 gallons of wine is, you'd think that's a lot of wine, but we don't know how many people were there. In order to fill up containers that, so let's say it was 72 gallons of water, and he said, you know, to fill them to the brim, fill them to the brim, you don't just put a little bit of water in. To get 72 gallons of water in a desert setting, where there was probably a well in the middle of the town, well, it's going to take a while. Because obviously one man couldn't go to the well and come back with a thing that had 72 gallons of water in it. So they probably had to do it a couple of gallons at a time, get some container, dump it into the stone jars. And Jesus wanted them filled to the brim. So that took some time. And it took some work. Now, the people at the wedding, and the other thing to keep in mind before we go on, the people at the wedding don't realize this is going on. You know, they're getting in line to get a little more food. Somebody says, hey, bring me another glass of wine. And everybody's going, oh, no, we're going to have three more glasses left. But they don't really realize what these guys are doing, because, you know, the servants didn't work out in the middle of the where the celebration was. This was probably in the back or on the side. So some period of time goes by, which we're going to get to that in a second. So they're filled to the brim, and now it doesn't tell us anything that Jesus said. It doesn't say anything that he prayed over it. It doesn't say anything that he spent some time, you know, walking around the room. It doesn't say anything. Except he says now, which means they filled it to the brim. He says, now take some to the head steward and have him taste it. So it was immediate. He didn't say, I better taste this first to make sure it worked. Yeah, to make sure this is really wine. I mean, make sure it's not like some diluted wine, you know, half water, half wine. He didn't say, I better check to make sure it's not grape juice. He doesn't worry about the quality of it. He says, go take it to the waiter. So he's of course very sure that this is what he did. Uh-huh. He's very sure that the miracle was completed and was the result. I mean, he knew what the result was. He didn't need to check it. So this shows, so this is power over nature, because the substance of the water is changed by his will. And like I say, there's no indication that human Jesus said, how am I going to do this? What should I do? Should I say some special prayer? Should I, is there something in the prayer book about this? Or no, you just go check it, go take it. So the substance of it's changed. And interestingly, Moses' first miracle was turning water into blood. And his first miracle is turning water into wine. So when you think about that, it's law versus grace. Blood, you know, it's a symbol of punishment, terror, humanity, kind of the life of people. You know, when blood's oozing out of you, your life is oozing out of you. Your life is in the blood. Grace is, of course, hopeful, happy. You get what you don't deserve, which is happy. That's a happy situation. That's why the gospel's good news. So Jesus takes wine, turns water into something that is celebratory. Like the Bible says, wine makes the heart glad. Paul tells Timothy, drink a little wine to settle your stomach. They always talk about wine as a celebration. Makes your heart glad. So instead of turning water into blood, he turns water into wine. Contrast between law and grace. So these jugs that are there also are signs of the law. Because you have to wash things in a certain way. You have to wash the glasses, the dishes, the pots, the cups. And you have to keep the water moving. You know, the water can't sit around. So you have to keep pouring the water out of it, pouring the water out of it. Some of it's the law, some of it was tradition. But, I mean, even the washing of the hands at the Seder, you know, you don't, when you get to Exodus 12, which is the first Passover, there's nothing in there about washing your hands while you're eating. But that got added later. So a lot of stuff was added, and Jesus said, you know, your traditions make my word of no effect, because you're teaching tradition just like you're teaching the law. So they had added so many traditions that along with the 613 laws, there were like 2,000 more traditions, and the Pharisees expected you to keep all of that, which is clearly even more impossible. So these things are signs of the law, but then they hold a happy substance, which is the symbol of grace and joy and happiness, and the sign of the new covenant, as you were just saying, and the sign of the new covenant. Both covenants are sealed in blood, but wine is the blood of the new covenant, the new and eternal covenant. So you have law, but then it's filled with a new covenant. It's filled with grace. It's filled with exciting stuff. Because Jesus always gives abundantly. So I wanted the jars filled to the brim. Just like David says, my cup overflows. You know, happiness makes everything overflow. You fill the glass up till it's pouring out. He always gives abundantly. So he doesn't just say, you know, put a couple of gallons of water in these things and just fill them all up to the brim. We're going to make joy. We're going to make, like, big joy. We're going to make, like, total happiness. And Moses, you know, Moses was a servant. You know, Moses is always called the servant of God. Moses is always called. When we go to heaven, we're going to sing the song of Moses, the servant of God, and the song of the Lamb. So for people who don't like to study the Torah, they're going to not have any fun. Because you have to sing about, you have to sing about Moses, too. So when you have your little harp, you know, you'll be playing the song. Then you'll say, after a while, you'll say, could we do another song? Can we do some Chris Tomlin? You know, Moses was a servant. He went to the rock to get water. These servants go to the rock to get wine. So these stone jars, and the miracle happens immediately after they're filled. So it's a contrast between law and grace. So Paul says, by the works of the law, no flesh will be saved. Because you You can't keep the law. You can't earn your way. You cooperate with it, but you don't earn it. Okay? Flaw to grace, new creation. Numbers of the days, just like Genesis. He does kind of a takeoff of what Moses did. Now, they wouldn't have realized that then, obviously. Because after all, you're at a wedding, having fun. You know, the apostles aren't, of course, they probably couldn't have put three thoughts together, but I'm sure they couldn't have, I'm sure they didn't sit there analyzing the theology of it till after Pentecost. Then they're probably meeting somewhere and one of them says, hey, you know, Jesus made wine out of water and Moses turned water into blood. Wow. Because a lot of that stuff, you know, like he always said, you know, when the Spirit comes, then you're going to understand all this stuff. You can't possibly understand it before. You can't possibly understand it. And that's why Paul says it's all foolishness to those that are perishing. Because you can't say that's ridiculous. And so this wine that is taken out, you know, this is meant to be used by the people there. They're going to drink it. I mean, Jesus doesn't say, well, see, I just wanted to show you what I could do. You know, I'm glad you think it's good. And, it, you know, just like we get, you know, just like you were talking about through the Holy Spirit, you get gifts of the Spirit. The gifts are meant to be used. The wine's meant to be used. Everything we get is meant to be used. You know, nowhere in the Bible does it say your faith is a private matter. You're never supposed to discuss it. You're supposed to shout it from the rooftops. So, you know, you don't leave the gifts, you know, where they are. Just like the wine wasn't just meant to stay in those jugs, jars. But now think about this. It took a long time for the servants to get 72 gallons of water or whatever it was and pour it in those things. Now look what it says in... I love this part. In verse 9, the waiter in charge tasted the water made wine without knowing where it had come from. Only the waiters knew. Only the servants knew where it came from. Now think about that. Big party going on. They're almost out of wine. Everybody's eating. Everybody's half-crocked. Some people are probably drunk. These guys take, I don't know, 20 minutes, 30 minutes, an hour to fill these things up with water in a desert. They have to go get the water. And then they're standing there having filled these jars up to the brim. And Jesus says to one of them, go take some to the head steward, the head waiter. Because, wow, this is good wine. Why? Wow, you're bringing out the good wine late. Wow, that's pretty. Nobody knew where it came from except the servants knew. We as servants see the miracles that go on. We as servants see the gifts that are given. We as servants know what he's doing. When people say, I never hear God saying anything, I go, well, you're not listening. He's talking to you all the time. Maybe put your stupid, turn your stupid TV off and shut your phone off and maybe like sit someplace quiet and listen for a while. You might be surprised. But, you know, if you're following him, you know what he's doing. And, you know, in one of the, I can't remember, I think it's in Isaiah, where it says a servant's eyes are always on the master's hand because he gives signals. You know, go get me that. Go put this over there. He doesn't have to say, go put this over here. He just goes. So if you're a servant, you're tuned into what the Lord's doing. And so things happen around you. The people around you don't know or don't know where the thing came from. But you know because you're the servant. The servants knew. You know, when the 5,000 were fed, and that's 5,000 men, so it might have been 15,000, might have been 20,000, I don't know. If you were in the back of that whole crowd and you're kind of hungry, you say, man, we've been here all day and we're kind of hungry. And here comes some guy and says, hey, I got some fish and some bread. You say, oh, great. That guy's got fish and some bread. You don't realize at that moment where it came from. But you say, oh, good, we have it. But the people that saw him multiply the bread and then went and passed it out, they knew where it had come from. So these servants knew. They knew one thing for sure. They put water in those jars. Because they didn't have a well in the middle of town that had wine coming out of it. They could have never gone to a Giant Eagle and bought enough wine. And they could have never drank it.
They didn't have a box of wine.
Yeah. I need 72 gallons of wine. So how cool is that? I can't even stand it. So in verse 12, we have this, another kind of little verse. After this, he went to Capernaum, along with his mother and brothers and his disciples, and they stayed there only a few days. Okay. So what? So what? So then he goes to Capernaum. Now, Capernaum then becomes kind of the center of the ministry. Nazareth's out of the picture now. Capernaum becomes the center. And he basically lives at Peter's house. I'm sure you went to that church that's built above Peter's house in Capernaum. It's kind of a modern-looking church with... It's all surrounded by windows so you can look out over.
I don't think it was completed.
Oh, wow, that must have been a long time ago.
1999.
So they go to Capernaum. And then we're going to find out Passover is at hand, which means what? He's got to go to Jerusalem. That's probably why he didn't stay in Capernaum very long. Mm-hmm. So if he walked there, let's say 40, 45-minute drive, it probably would have been the better part of a day. And I love the synagogue that's there. You know, you remember the synagogue at Capernaum? I love it because the, you know, Bread of Life discourse in John 6, you know, toward the end of it, it said he did this teaching in the synagogue of Capernaum. So even though it's, when we've been there, it's been so hot, I love to just sit in the ruins of that synagogue and think about him doing the Bread of Life discourse. Now, somebody start reading at, 13 down.
Since the Passover of the Jews was near, Jesus went up to Jerusalem. He found in the temple area those who sold oxen, sheep, and doves, as well as the money changers seated there. He made a whip out of cords and drove them all out of the temple area with the sheep and oxen and spilled the coin of money changers and overturned their tables. And to those who sold doves, he said, take these out of here and stop making my father's house a marketplace. His disciples recall the words of scripture, zeal for your house will consume me.
Okay, let's pause there. So this is the first Passover that's mentioned that Jesus takes part in. Obviously, he's going to die on Passover 3 years later, but this is the first documented Passover. Now, Passover, of course, is one of the three pilgrimage feasts, so every man has to go to Jerusalem. So he would have been in Jerusalem every Passover from the time he was a kid. No question. Because he would have observed the law. Joseph would have taken him when he was a kid. After that, he would have gone. Women were not obliged to go, but they most likely went.
Okay.
And the fact that Jesus dies at Passover is important because there's so many more people in the city than would normally be there so that they could see the sacrifice. And the fact that the cross was on a main road that went in and out of the city, all kind of people going in and out of the city. So it was a public thing. But so every Passover after this, of course, is going to be mentioned. And this is the first time we hear about him doing something in the temple since he was 12. This is usually called the purification in the temple. So Malachi 3:1 tells us that the Savior that you hope for will suddenly come to the temple. That was his presentation. of day 40. The Messiah suddenly came to the temple, although they didn't know it. And then if you want to go back to, again in Malachi, who of course was the last prophet, 400 years before Jesus. In Malachi 3, 2 and 3, but who will endure the day of his coming, and who can stand when he appears? For he is like a refiner's fire or like the fuller's lye. He will sit refining and purifying. He will purify the sons of Levi, refining them like gold or like silver, that they may offer due sacrifice to the Lord. Then the sacrifice of Judah and Jerusalem will please the Lord as in the days of old, as in years gone by. So you got to clean up the sacrificial system. So, of course, he's going to be the ultimate sacrificial system. But here, these guys who are commonly called the money changers, they had to sell animals at the temple. Because if you read through the Torah, you can't always bring your own animals. You know, if you come from, you know, someplace north of Nazareth, you got to go to the temple and do a sacrifice. It might not be easy for you to bring animals. If you live in Jerusalem, you don't have a flock of sheep that you can just go get a lamb. So they have to have access to buying a lamb. In fact, Passover was the day that they bought the lamb. I mean, Palm Sunday was the day that they bought the lamb for the Passover. And of course, the true lamb came into the city while people were shopping for a lamb without blemish. And if you had any question about your lamb, you called the priest and you said, can I use this lamb? And the priest would examine it very carefully and say, oh, no, look, he's got a spot. Can't use this one. Oh, yeah, this one is okay. So they reject the true lamb, but they inspect all the real lambs that are acceptable for sacrifice. That's kind of an aside. But so they weren't supposed to be in that part of the grounds. And, you know, these guys also probably paid some money to the Levites and said, hey, how about if I set up my sheep over here? I don't know, these guys that were doing the selling and changing, and the reason they're called money changers too is they had a currency exchange. Because when you came with coins, you had Roman coins, Greek coins, other kind of coins, you had to convert them to the temple coin. Or else you couldn't use them in the temple. You couldn't pay the tithe. Because the Levites had to have the temple currency. There were money changers there. It was like a, you know, currency exchange kind of place. Yeah. What's the rate today?
Double what it was yesterday.
Yeah. So, and they probably paid the holy guys. And, you know, we'll give you 200 shekels if I could set my, oh, sure, go ahead. Nobody cares. They had to have it in the area. But so these guys were a little too close, and they weren't supposed to be right in the temple grounds. Because after all, this is the holiest place on earth where God puts his name. There's no other place it says in the Bible God put his name except this place. And these guys were running it like a, I don't know what you even call it. So, and who knows, you know, they're cheating you on the currency exchange and they're saying, hey, I don't think that lamb, I think that lamb's worth way more than you think it's worth. So if you don't get a lamb, you can't go in. So, hey, you gotta better buy this one. So we can only imagine. Jesus doesn't go and complain about this. He doesn't say, hey, you guys, I'm going to go inside and find some, you know, big shot Levite to go complain to. I'm going to see if I can make an appointment with the high priest to see if we can do something about this. He takes care of it himself. Doesn't go tell anybody. You know, they had made a business out of being in the holy place. And then he gives the reason for why he's doing this. You know, this is a house of prayer, and you people turned it into a, depending which translation you have, den of thieves, marketplace. You know, he didn't want the holy place to be contaminated like this, with all this business going on. And then, of course, there were people probably very observant, faithful people that were you know, trying to go into the temple to pray and try to do the thing. And they had to deal with all these guys going, hey, want to buy a temple souvenir? Hey, want to get a, you know. By not going, I mean, an average person, a normal person, whatever you want to call it, wouldn't have been able to do such a thing. Because this was under the control of the priests. So what he's showing by that is he has the authority to take care of this. He doesn't have to go get, you know, a human. He doesn't have to go to a human and say, hey, can I go out there and tell those? He just does it. He has the authority to do it. And says it's his father's house. So, you know, like it says in Hebrews, he's the son of the house. Moses was a servant of the house. He's a son of the house. Oh, the wrong verse. It's Psalm 69:10. It says, because zeal for your house consumes me, and the insults of those who blaspheme you fall upon me. So, you know, David, of course, is writing that. But he's, you know, when he does this, as you see here, his disciples recalled. See, these guys were brighter than I was giving them credit for. They recalled the words of the scriptures, zeal for your house consumes me. The zeal, yep. God always has zeal for his name. And he had zeal for his house. Do you remember in the Torah, and you'll see it through the whole Old Testament, how much time God spends talking about his name? You know, my name, my name, my name, my name. Second only to the Sabbath. Sabbath, the Sabbath, the Sabbath, the Sabbath. Over and over again. You know, Dave, it's interesting that David's writing the Psalms, and then you see these like messianic prophecies that are kind of embedded in them. You know? He's talking, and then it's actually Jesus who's talking through him, and so it's really cool prophecy. And of course, Jesus also has zeal for his house, which is the church. And now here's where it gets to the authority. As you see, somebody wants to read from 18 to the end.
The Jews reacted by asking Jesus, "What miracle can you show us to justify what you're doing?" Jesus replied, "Tear down this temple, and I will rebuild it in 3 days." The Jews said, "It took 46 years to build this temple. Do you really think you could rebuild it in 3 days?" But the temple Jesus spoke about was his own body, and after it came back to life, his disciples remembered that he had said this, so they believed the scripture and the statement that Jesus had made. Now, I always think that he must have pointed to himself, like, tear down this temple.
Yeah, read it till the end.
Okay. While Jesus was in Jerusalem at the Passover festival, many people believed him because they saw the miracles that he performed. Jesus, however, was wary of these believers. He understood people, and he didn't need anyone to tell him about human nature. He knew what people were really like.
Yeah. It's interesting John puts that in. So, of course, they want to know by what authority, you know, like they always were asking him questions. By what authority do you do this? You know, we know one thing, we didn't give you the authority to do it. You know, by what authority do you say these things? We never gave you a certificate to preach. You know, we never gave you a diploma saying you could preach. You know, by what authority do you do these things? And when they test, I love the time where he says, okay, I'm going to ask you a question. You know, John's baptism, was it from God or was it from men? And they said, well, gee, you know, if we say it's from God, he's going to say, why didn't you believe him? And if they say it's from man, they would say, gee, people love John the Baptist. We don't know. And he says, well, then I'm not going to tell you either. He didn't have the need to dispute his authority with a bunch of Levitical priests. They were doing what they were supposed to do, though, because that's what the law says a Levite does. They're the ministers. But he's not gonna argue and debate with them about his authority, because all authority in heaven and earth has been given to him. So here, you know, they want a sign. You know, instead of saying, oh, you know, it's good you got these guys out of here, and it's good, you know, you're purifying the temple, you're, purifying God's house. No, they don't say, good. I'm glad you did that. You know, we should have done too, but, you know, we just didn't get around to it. We have a committee that's looking into it. They don't ask him, you know, they don't say that. They say, we want a sign. How can you have this authority? Then he goes to a future sign and destroy this temple. Maybe he did point to himself. And in 3 days, I'm going to build it back up. And they, of course, because he's a stone of stumbling, they stumbled right over this. Ha! It took 46 years to build this temple. You're going to build it in 3 days? And you notice he doesn't address them anymore on it. He doesn't say, yeah, as a matter of fact, I am. Or, yeah, I'm talking about my body. Oh, I'm talking about, yeah, you're going to see in a couple of years. You're going to see about it. You know, he doesn't dispute it with them. And the guys, see, maybe they're a little brighter than I give them credit. No, of course, because later they're going to be filled with the Spirit. Because it says, only after Jesus had been raised from the dead that his disciples recall that he had said this. So they went, oh, he said destroy a temple and rebuild it in 3 days. Oh, he rose at the third day. Oh, you know, they recalled it. Yeah, so he goes with a future thing, and that's going to prove he's Messiah. Going to prove it. Because, you know, it's a stumbling block. And, of course, you know, it says in other places, one greater than the temple is here. He's greater than the temple. They couldn't conceive of something greater than the temple except the Shekinah, the presence of God. So when he says, I'm, you know, one greater than the temple is here, he's equating himself to God. He's equating himself to the Shekinah glory. So that gets them mad too, because they would consider that blasphemy. Yeah, so through the Spirit they remember. It took time, but then they got what he said. So how cool is that? So that's chapter 2.